So this is our lesson entitled The Need for Ezra's Help. We have thus far covered Zerubbabel. We covered, obviously, the very first lesson was a tremendous overview of Old Testament history. And then we went into what the Samaritans were and what syncretism was. Then we covered Zerubbabel and him coming back from Babylon and Persia to build the temple and the opposition he faced. So this brings us now forward in time to the timeline of Ezra and what Ezra did. We're calling this How to Build Revival, or a study of post-exilic Israel and revival building, because this was a giant revival that was going on. It lasted over 100 years, we said, from the time Zerubbabel came back. He began a revival that lasted over 100 years, literally until the time Jesus Christ was born. And it was a revival of the law, a revival of Moses' law, a revival of Israel as a nation. Because up until this point, they really hadn't been a faithful nation to God at all, and they were carried away as slaves into Babylon for 70 years. So beginning with Zerubbabel, he fulfilled Jeremiah's prophecy, he fulfilled Isaiah's prophecy, and Israel began to go back home for the first time. And this time it was different. They went home and they were going to be faithful. And from this point forward, they never worshiped idols again. All throughout Israel's entire history, even beginning with Jacob, whose name was changed into Israel. Jacob flirted with idols, and that was taken into Egypt. They picked up more idols in Egypt. Of course, they came out making a golden calf. And even from that day forward, Israel was always flirting with idols and idolatry. There was always somebody burning something to under a green tree somewhere, somebody always worshiping Ashtaroth or Baal, somebody always worshiping. They even worshiped Moses' rod with the brazen serpent on it. And in Israel, they always had the golden calf being worshipped in Samaria, in Jezreel. Always. This is the first time Israel, in almost 1,200 years, is going to be faithful. Amen. Hopefully, it won't take us as Christians to learn that. We don't have 1,200 years to learn how to be faithful. No. Once they came back from the exile, they never, ever, ever again tolerated demon worship. They established the synagogues. They established the Pharisaical religious department. They established the worship that actually is even modeled in our church today. We covered this last week. The synagogues were developed in Babylon because they had no temple to worship in, so they had to have home meetings. They had to have home meetings with a leader over each home meeting. That became the synagogue form of worship. That was brought back from exile into Israel. And that was the prominent form of worship when Jesus came to the scene. And he was going from synagogue to synagogue. And he would stand up, read the book of the law, read Isaiah the prophet, then he would sit down to teach. He did that in synagogues. He did that in a place of worship they developed in Babylon because they had no temple anymore. Then the church is born, Acts chapter 2, and everything just picks up back in the synagogue. Local houses of worship where there's a seat of authority and the law is read and the word is preached and people worship God. As we pointed out in James' epistle, he says, when you come together in your assemblies, he's talking to Christians and churches, but when he says there in James, when you come together in your assemblies, how do you have respect of persons? It's a Greek word, synagogue. So even the apostle James is addressing Christians who are still meeting in synagogues. It's the model we have today. Now, we don't call this a synagogue, it's called the church, but the pattern is very much modeled after what they developed in Babylon out of necessity when they realized we are a very wretched people who have been very unfaithful to our God. Let us gather to our God, lest we be wiped out as a people. That's what they did. So Zerubbabel began that revival, lasted really almost 400 years to the coming of Jesus Christ. But we're looking at this, a study of post-exilic Israel or after the exile, and we're seeing some things here. Let's jump into this. Every revival requires sound doctrine and teaching to maintain momentum and prevent perversion and goofiness from entering in. Amen. Every revival, whether it was the Azusa Street revival, eventually petered out. Even the healing revival of the 40s and 50s, which was the last great revival this nation saw, that's 70 years ago, it petered out because of perversion. It's very hard to maintain a revival because the devil always enters in and people go to excesses. But every great revival needs good teaching and doctrine. Israel's post-exilic revival was no different. Approximately 58 years after the second temple was completed, remember that was Zerubbabel's temple, 58 years later, God raised up a leader to bring about spiritual reforms in Israel. His name was Ezra. So Ezra does not come on the scene till the second temple that Zerubbabel built has been completed 58 years. So that's how long we have, almost not literally, but there's almost a gap in the Bible record of nearly 58 years. We're going to see that we have some things that go on there. But that's how long it is from Zerubbabel, and the revival is still going on. And then all of a sudden, something starts to happen and wane, and God has to raise up Ezra. But let's look at this next part. We're not only studying types and shadows with this, but we're also trying to give you a good working knowledge of the biblical setting of Ezra and Nehemiah and help you to understand how this applies to us. So let's look at Jerusalem between Zerubbabel and Ezra. What was going on in Jerusalem from the time the second temple was built and Zerubbabel, he was the governor of Jerusalem under the Persian kings. What went on there after he died until Ezra had to be raised up? During the 58 years between Zerubbabel's completion of the second temple and the ministry of Ezra, the Jews in Jerusalem had moved on to rebuilding the city and the walls. The famous walls of Jerusalem were already under construction during the second temple, as is evident from the opposition waged against Zerubbabel. Now, this is critical because as we study Nehemiah, it almost seems miraculous that he could build the walls in 52 days. And if all you ever do is jump into Nehemiah and don't realize that Ezra and Nehemiah were at one point one book and extensions of 2 Chronicles, it'll seem like the walls haven't been touched in 120 years. But what you see when you study Ezra very closely is that really the same time they began building the temple, they also began construction on walls and the city. But the temple was emphasized. And all throughout these 70 so years, the wall was always being worked on. That's something you do not pick up. I've never heard it taught. I had to start digging into all this and start reading these big theological papers and arguments and dissertations to start to uncover it and realize the walls had been talked about all through Ezra. But when all you're ever familiar with is Nehemiah, you just think, well, he showed up. He was crying because of something that was done 120 years earlier. Because Nehemiah was born in captivity. He had never seen the walls or heard about the city or seen the city. So when you read Nehemiah chapter 1, it almost sounds like he hears for the first time the walls have been destroyed. Well, they've been destroyed his whole life. So it doesn't make any sense that Nehemiah would weep over something he knew about his whole life. He was a captivity dweller. He knew about it. This, what we're going to see here, makes a lot more sense in building up and leading into Nehemiah. So look at Ezra chapter 5, verse 3. At the same time came to them Tatnai, governor on this side, the river, and Shethar-Boznai, and their companions, and said thus unto them, Zerubbabel and the elder, who hath commanded you to build this house and to make up this wall. Who hath commanded you to build this house and to make up this wall? So Zerubbabel, that them refers to Zerubbabel, and he's building the temple. That's what he's known for. But notice that this governor, this Samaritan governor, Tatnai, he says, who has commanded you to build this house and to make this wall? So even under the time of Zerubbabel, the wall is being built. The Samaritans have come down. We covered Samaritans last time. They came down and they said, we want to help. And Zerubbabel said, you can't help. Then they said, well, fine, we hate you. Sounds like Christians. If I can't play with you, then I'm taking your toys and my toys and I'm going home. We want to help you build a place for our God. We worship your God like he's our God ever since we came from Assyria. You can't help us. Then we hate you. But the accusation is, who has commanded you to build this house and these walls? So evidently, from the very beginning, the walls were under construction as well. A letter was written to King Darius by the regional governor, Tatnai. Zerubbabel did not deny that the walls were being rebuilt. Notice he doesn't say, No, just the city. We're just building the house of God. And these walls, that's a false accusation. He doesn't deny it. That also lets us know, according to history, the walls were under construction from the very beginning. And that sometimes gets overlooked. That is so critical if you want to reconcile the book of Nehemiah. How could him and just a handful rebuild the wall in 52 days? It was been under construction for 70 years. They just finished it and set the gates in place. This means that the walls were already being built as early as 520 BC, or about 75 years before Nehemiah completed the work. That makes a lot more sense. especially when you see the map of antiquity that shows how big the walls were. The work of rebuilding the city and the walls continued after Zerubbabel and is evident from the opposition they received as recorded in Ezra. Now, I know this is more like a classroom setting, so just really stay awake, pay attention. Shame on you if you stayed up too late and you're going to doze off on me because you're going to miss stuff. Because I don't spend all this time, because I don't have anything else to do studying this stuff. It's not like I said, you know what? I'm bored. I think I'll study Ezra. I have nothing better to do with my weeks. God has us here for a purpose. Let's go back here, and I've written it in. Let's review the order of the Persian kings. This is remarkable because they had favor with every Persian king. When they were sinful, the Babylonians couldn't stand them and wiped them out. But when the fulfillment of Jeremiah's prophecy came, they had favor with every Persian king. All right? So let's remember the order of the Persian kings. There was King Cyrus. Also, the power of learning is repetition. You hear it over again and over again. Cyrus, this is the king prophesied about in Isaiah. He was the king to release them back. He was the one that ended the 70-year captivity and gave them favor. He was the first king to release the Jews. He supported Zerubbabel after discovering himself in Isaiah's prophecies. I just uncovered this week in research that it is a Jewish tradition. We said last time that the Jews brought to Cyrus this prophecy of Isaiah that says, "Oh, my shepherd Cyrus, you will release my people. You will build my city. You will build me a house." One place I had studied previously said the Jews. Another Jewish tradition I just uncovered this week said it was actually Daniel himself who knew Cyrus, who brought to Cyrus the prophecy of Isaiah and said, "This is you, king." Daniel was a governor under Babylonian rule. He was held in high esteem. And Nebuchadnezzar favored Daniel. And then once Cyrus overthrew Nebuchadnezzar and took over and became the Persian Empire, he would have been under Cyrus as well. Jewish tradition holds that Daniel himself was the one that pointed out to Cyrus, "Our prophets talked about you 200 years ago." So that's the first Persian king, great favor. And he said, "Go build whatever you want to, and here, take a whole bunch of money with you." Because to him, it was just a 900-mile city, a city 900 miles away on his far reachings of his perimeter. And he said, "Do whatever you got to do because I don't want God mad at me." And that's what he did. Isaiah also calls, this is what's crazy, Isaiah calls Cyrus God's anointed pastor. A Persian king. God called him my anointed shepherd that will do all my will. I like that. Then there was Cambyses. He's the son of Cyrus. He never hindered anything the Jews were doing. He's not recorded of in the Bible. His name is not mentioned. He was known in antiquity for his battles in Egypt. He actually died fighting the Egyptian revolts. Then after him was Pseudo-Smerdis Gamata. He was an imposter. He took the throne while Cambyses was away. And then Darius came. And there's some discussion in history whether Darius fabricated the story that Pseudo-Smerdis was an imposter so he could seize the throne or whether he truly was an imposter. But we know God used Darius. This Darius recommissioned the building of the second temple. They had had a lot of opposition, a lot of discouragement. After Cyrus died, the Samaritans rose up and began to buffet and afflict the Jews who were building the house, including Zerubbabel. And they were discouraged and they quit for 2 years. And they even wrote letters to this new president. You know, they always, whenever somebody else comes to power, you want to see how much you can get away with him. It's like the substitute teacher, the rebellious teenage brats in high school. They always want to see what they can get away with the new leader. It's politics. Same with churches. When I took over, we had a bunch of rebellious Jezebel idiots who wanted to see what they could get away with here. That's all they were doing with Darius. So they wrote new letters of accusation. And they said, they're building the city, they're building the walls, they're building the city. And Darius made search and said, Cyrus said, do it, so don't stop them. So they had great favor with another Persian king, Darius. Then after Darius was Xerxes. Xerxes famous from the Battle of Thermopylae, but that was also King Ahasuerus of the Book of Esther. And he married Esther, but he received letters against the Jews, but he did nothing about it. He was too busy being married to one, saving the Jews' lives. So any accusation you make against the Jews to Xerxes, he's too busy fighting Greeks and Egyptians. He doesn't have time for little Samaritan half-breeds. So he never responded to the letter written of accusation against the Jews. That brings us to Artaxerxes. This was the final king of our Bible record. He ordered any work on the city of Jerusalem and its wall to be halted. but then granted Nehemiah permission to return to Jerusalem and complete the wall. So that's just a review of your Persian kings: Cyrus, Cambyses, Pseudo-Smerdis, Darius, Xerxes, and Artaxerxes. So I want to look at the opposition, because it shows that the walls in the city were being built the whole time, not just the house, but the walls in the city. Don't forget, when Nebuchadnezzar left Israel the third time, after he was taking everybody away as prisoners and slaves, he left nothing in existence. He broke down the walls, he burned the temple, he destroyed the city. So all three things are wanting. You need a house of God, you need a city to dwell in, and you need walls to protect it. So all three have to be worked on. So opposition under King Darius. Remember, this is after Cambyses, Pseudo-Smerdis, Darius. Darius is still in the time of Zerubbabel. And we're looking towards why we need Ezra's help. Okay? When King Darius' decree in Ezra 6:6 through 12, with it seems that all opposition to the Jewish revival and construction projects ceased. They were always being opposed, but King Darius comes along and he issued a decree. And what the Samaritans had written to them was, search out. These Jews are saying, if you'll search out, you'll find that they've been commissioned by King Cyrus, your predecessor. And what is fascinating is that King Darius, who has a huge empire to run, he receives letters from these little half-breeds against the Jews. And he says, you know what? I'll do that. I'll go make search for records as the Jews request to see if there's any record that King Cyrus commissioned them to do this. And so he does. And the Bible tells us he sends to another city, not even his royal city, because the royal city had moved in his day. He sent to the previous city to go look for records. So he has to commission somebody to go do that and not stop till you find it. Well, what if it doesn't even exist? Do they just keep doing that till they die? But this is how much favor was upon the Jews with even King Darius, that he would go search out to see, did Cyrus ever make any kind of royal edict, any kind of royal decree that said the Jews have every right to build this temple? And he did, and it was in a city a couple hundred miles to the north in a place of records, and they found it. And when King Darius found that record, when I read it, I'm amazed that he even took the time to do it, knowing that he has the Persian Empire to run. He receives one false letter of accusation. I throw away 20 letters a day in this church. No, no, no. God bless you, but I ain't supporting you. No. And he bothered to take the time. It was the favor of God upon them, which is why we often say around here, you ought to pray for the favor of God. It'll do more for you than really even your faith can do. Just let the favor of God follow you. Believe God for favor with your bosses, with the city, with the school teacher, with the principal, with the professors. Believe God for favor. Because these Jews, now Zerubbabel had never met Darius. This is a brand new king 900 miles away. And he's got to believe God for favor. So he finds it. And sure enough, he finds the decree that Cyrus had initiated this thing. So this is what Darius says. Also, I have made a decree that whosoever shall alter this word or this decree, let timber be pulled down from his house, and after being set up, let him be hanged thereon, and let his house be made a dunghill for this. Well, for what? For altering the decree that said, help the Jews build the house. A Persian king said that. And the God that hath caused his name to dwell there, destroy all kings and people that shall put their hand to alter and to destroy the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. I, Darius, have made a decree. Let it be done with speed. Well, when the king says that, everybody shuts up and gets to work. And they suffered no more opposition all the days of Darius, which was about a 30-year reign. A Persian king who had no dealings with the Jews, but he was honoring Cyrus's decree from some 50 years prior or 20 years prior. That's favor. There is no record that the Samaritans or regional governors moved against Israel the rest of King Darius's reign. They would have to wait for a new king. That's politics. So the next king after Darius dies is Ahasuerus. So there we have opposition under King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes the First. Eventually, Darius was replaced by King Ahasuerus. The Samaritans wasted no time in attacking the Jews. Now remember, the Samaritans are the mixed folks. They're half Jew, half everything else. They worship Jehovah and everything else. These are what we'd call lukewarm Christians. These are what we call Christians who know how to play the game, who have one speech for the world and one speech for church, who have one way they live in, with their friends and one way they live in the church. And God couldn't stand them, and neither could God's people. Remember we covered syncretism last week? So these Samaritans, these half-breeds, they wasted no time. They see a new king. Now keep in mind, Persia, or the palace of Shushan, is 900 miles away. To travel is 5 months. So think about how long it takes for word to travel. You have a new king. Even if you're running horses or really fast camels across the desert, it's still going to take 2 or 3 months for word to spread. We have a new king. So as soon as the Samaritans hear, we have a new king, they waste no time. Look at Ezra 4:6. And in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, wrote they unto him an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. So the beginning reign would be, we heard you're reigning. Here's our letter. Let's draft it. We get together with all the Confederates in our little Samaritan half-breed Jew party. And let's see what we can slander against them now. This is the danger of syncretism, the synchronizing of the gospel with everything else. You're always opposing that which is pure and true. That is why we have to fight to keep any kind of perversion out of our life. That's why if your arm offends you, cut it off. We, with our emotions, we, with our petty excuses, we try to synchronize our relationship with Jesus Christ with everything else, and it never works. Here, these half-breeds, in the beginning, they offered to help, but because they were not pure, Zerubbabel said, "You can't help us. You're not qualified." And now, dozens of years later, they're still bitter. And really, the demon of syncretism is still opposing the pure move of God. And they don't waste any time. As soon as they hear that Xerxes or Ahasuerus, same name, same king, he becomes king, they, in the beginning of his reign, they draft a letter of accusation against the Jews in Judah. Now, the funny thing is, he doesn't ever seem to pay any attention to it. For all the hasty political maneuvering on the part of the Samaritans, there's no Bible record that King Ahasuerus did anything about the accusation, nor is there any record of him having any dealings with the Jews in Jerusalem. He just left it alone. If he did, we don't know it. He was too busy. We know from history he was too busy dealing with the revolt in Egypt, which was part of his kingdom. And, of course, the famous one is the Battle of Thermopylae as he was trying to fight the Greeks and the Spartans. He was too busy dealing with those to fool with a little territory called Judea. So he didn't even bother with it. Plus, he was married to a Jewess, Esther. So he's already killed Haman for insurrection. So why would he do anything else? It's just the favor of God on the Persian Empire towards the Jews. Construction of the wall and city would have been able to continue during the 21 year of King Ahasuerus. So the Samaritans tried to stop it, the pure move of God, the reconstruction of God's city, the reconstruction of God's people. They tried to oppose it with this new king to no avail, so it goes unabated. It goes unhindered, and it keeps going. And where this is history, and I know maybe it's a little bogged down in minutiae, but we're building momentum here. Because they have favor with king, favor with king. Even Pseudo-Smerdis, Guamata, imposter, he's only there for 7 months. He doesn't have time to hinder them even if he was going to. Favor with him, favor with Darius, favor with the wicked Xerxes, who is notorious. Everybody's heard of Xerxes. There's movies about Xerxes. He doesn't hinder the Jews. Favor with him until we get to Artaxerxes. Which is why we're answering this question, why do we need Ezra's help? Ezra's name means help, by the way. So opposition under King Artaxerxes. Also, to step back and look at it, you're always going to have opposition. The enemy, the half-breed Christians, the lukewarm Christians, the religious Christians, they're always going to oppose you. But as long as you're doing what you know to do, it'll be unhindered. You'll be opposed, but you won't be opposed. They'll try to hinder you, but you'll just keep building what God's called you to build. That's why we want to apply this back to our life. There'll always be the devil trying to do something against the move of God. That's what the devil does. It's not like he has anything else to do. He doesn't get to take vacations. He doesn't do investments. He doesn't golf. He just is the accuser of the brethren. That's what he does. He walks up and down looking for something to hinder. And you have to make sure as a Christian, you can say as Jesus Christ did, "Now hath the prince of this world come, and he has found nothing in me." You got to make sure you have that testimony. Great opposition was met when Artaxerxes became king. A great confederacy of Assyrian colonists led by politicians wrote another letter. They're always slandering and making up lies. Notice what their letter indicated, Ezra 4, 12 and 13. Be it known unto the king that the Jews which came up from you to us are coming to Jerusalem. They are building the rebellious and bad city and have set up the walls thereof. So the walls are under construction. This is way before Nehemiah. And joined the foundations. Be it known unto the king that if this city be builded and these walls set up again, then will they not pay toll, tribute, and custom, so thou shalt endamage the revenue of the kings. Notice the verbiage of this one, the verbiage of this letter. This is your fault, king. You sent these Jews, and they're going to, you will be responsible for damaging the king's income. What a carefully worded, sneaky snake. Some of you are good at this kind of lingo. Wording things so that you look good and everything else looks bad. It's called guile. Painting only the picture that makes you look the most beautiful. Paint yourself in the best light to get what you want and not telling the full truth. And they said, furthermore, even as the previous half-breeds did, make search in the records. But whereas the previous Samaritan said, make search to see if King Cyrus even made the decree, these learned from their predecessor's mistake, and they said, make search and see if this isn't a rebellious people that have thrown off the rule of previous kings. They told him what to search for. And they realized, don't tell them to look for the good stuff, tell them to look for the bad stuff. That's the accuser of the brethren. Always looking for the bad. That's how Christians are when they operate in guile. They're pointing out the bad. And the thing about the bad is we can point it out in every one of us if we want to. But only the accuser of the brethren does that. Only Lucifer. That's how we know these are demonized people. They're half-breeds. Not just in their DNA, in their faith. We might ask the question, are you a half-breed in your faith? Part of you worships Jesus, part of you don't. Part of you worships everything else. Or you're a half-breed in that you worship Jesus on your terms. Or you serve God as it is convenient to you. Everything will begin to try to strip you from true Christianity, even down to your own family. When you deal with half-breeds, you're talking about family. And you got to make sure that not even your children can pull you away from Jesus Christ, not even your spouse. Amen. So, it is apparent from this letter of slander that the Jews were, in fact, still building the city and the walls all through the previous king's reign and into Artaxerxes' reign. Unlike his predecessor, Artaxerxes replied to this letter. So let's see what the reply was. Xerxes didn't even bother to reply. If he did, we don't have record of it. But let's see what Artaxerxes said. He says this, "Give you now commandment to cause these men to cease, and that this city be not builded until another commandment shall be given from me. Take heed now that you fail not to do this. Why should damage grow to the hurt of the kings?" This king is actually somewhat humble. He says, let's not hurt the kings. And he's taking responsibility. He doesn't realize that a bunch of half-breeds have put a false responsibility on him. But he seems to sound somewhat humble to say, let's stop this. And all right, if this is what's going on, he's a brand new king. Let's stop this so that we don't cause any more damage to the kings, not me, but all the other kings who are before and after me. Let's stop this, which is exactly what the Samaritans wanted to hear. Now, keep in mind, the Samaritans were half-breeds. They combined the worship of Jehovah with the worship of anything else they set their eyes on. And really, in that regard, they weren't a focused people. And that really defines how we are sometimes. We're not a focused people. A couple years ago, we did the remodeling, and with the testimony of one person when we did some investigation was they mind their own business and anybody else's business that comes within 5 feet of them. That's how the half-breeds worship Jehovah. They worship Jehovah and anything else that came within 5 feet of them. That's how we are sometimes as Christians. We worship Jesus, and then we give our attention to anything else that comes within 5 feet of us. And you know how flesh is, we all do, it'll get obsessed with anything. You never knew you liked A&W diet root beer till you had one. And now you have to buy 2 cases every time you go to Sam's. And before long, whereas a year ago you'd never even heard of A&W, now the Lord's dealing with you to fast it. That's just like your flesh, to set on anything that comes anywhere close and obsess over it. And sometimes you just got to know your flesh. It's not enough to fast it. You've got to cut the thing off. You just have to know your own strengths and weaknesses. Otherwise, you could become a Samaritan in your faith. I love Jesus and so many other things. And isn't that how so many Christians confess their faith? I love Jesus. We don't deny it. But what else do you love? See, that's guile. You're only presenting, oh, I love Jesus, but I also love the clubs. I love the bars. I love strange women. That's Samaritan faith. And it motivated them to fight against the pure over and over and over again. A lot of our churches have crept into this. We preach the gospel and entertainment and feel good and positivity and pop psychology and a lowered state. But we preach Jesus and everything else. Jesus is just the name you mention more than anybody else's name. He might have 10% of the ratio, whereas the 1,000 other things you preach have the other 90%. And we see that all the way back here, an attack on the pure move of God. And that's why we have to resist it. We have to hunt it down in our life. We have to smell it out, search it out, and make sure we don't give in to this. King Artaxerxes issued a decree empowering the regional governor and his fellow associates performing the same function. That's what the word means when it talks about he wrote a letter to his fellows or his companions. It's a unique word only used in Ezra when it talks about this person and his companions. It's a political term which basically means fellow associates performing the same function under the same king. When you read about that in Ezra 4, it lists all these different nationalities of people who it says King Ashurbanipal brought over from Assyria. So you had basically had chieftain tribes were gathered together with Rehum here to write a letter to Artaxerxes. So what you have is total pagans who worship demons, who were mad that the God of Israel is getting a special city. They write a letter. And unfortunately, the king Artaxerxes is duped. He's a baby king. How is he going to know 2,500 years ago what's going on 1,000 miles from him? But he gets one letter, and he does the research it recommends, which says, go see if these Israelites aren't a rebellious people. God himself would say, they are king. They are very rebellious people. Because that's what God would say of his own people. And he finds out that they are rebellious people. So he makes the best decision that he can. And he ends up empowering some very wicked people to halt the construction project. Rehum and his associates took the decree to heart and acted with extreme prejudice should be against Jerusalem. So look what it says here when they get this letter from Artaxerxes. Because we're about to ask the question, why do we need Ezra's help? Ezra 4:23. Now when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum and Shimshai the scribe and their companions, that's the word that means fellow associates performing the same function of the king, they went up in haste. They were just waiting for that letter to come. When's it coming? They went up in haste to Jerusalem and to the Jews, and they made them to cease. Cease what? The construction of the city and the construction of the walls. They made them to cease by force and by army. This is in the day of Ezra. Artaxerxes is the king that commissioned Ezra, and 13 years later, he commissioned Nehemiah. So if you go up in haste, because for 50, 60 years, you've been wanting to stop the Jews, and now you finally, for the first time in four kings, have their permission to do whatever it takes to force it, you're not going to have any kind of restraint. And the Hebrew says, actually, it's probably some Persian, because the book of Ezra and Nehemiah are written in several different languages. It says by force and by army, by power and by army. And at this point, we believe this is when the city was ransacked again and the wall was broken down and the gates burned with fire. That would make sense why in Nehemiah 1, he hears word that the walls have been broken down, that the city is under affliction and the gates have been burned with fire. That would make more sense because the original walls were broken down 120 years prior. And Nehemiah would not have been born in those days. As long as he'd been alive, he would have known the original Jerusalem to be toast. But all the construction he's heard about his whole adult life, he now has heard has been set back. That would make more sense as to why Nehemiah was so upset, why he prayed and fasted for 4 months before he went to the same king that commanded that to be done to ask for permission to go finish the wall. That makes a lot more sense. The anti-God, anti-Christ zeal was now authorized to do what it had attempted to do for the past two kings, destroy Jerusalem again. The second temple was left alone. It had been completed at least 50 years at this point. Something had gone horribly awry in Jerusalem to halt the 70-year-old revival. That's why we have an Ezra. What had happened? How come now for the first time in five kings, we have no favor? Why is this the first king to side against Israel? What's gone on? All right. So who was Ezra? All that to build up to this. Who was Ezra? Ezra, his name means help. He was from the tribe of Levi and a direct descendant of the chief priest Aaron. So he is a high priest. But there's no temple to high priest in. The Bible also describes him as a ready scribe in the law of Moses, so he was also a scribe. So in a nutshell, Ezra was both the high priest and a scribe. By scribe, we mean those that translate or transliterate or transcribe the Bible. He would have been able to quote the entire Bible, the entire Torah, because he was always copying it. He was very well versed in it. He was able to be a high priest to make intercession for Israel and also to teach them the law that they had abandoned. So what goes on here? Ezra sought counsel with the king Artaxerxes and made a request of him. Look at Ezra 7:6. This Ezra, after the previous verses talk about his pedigree, because there were several Ezras, but this Ezra, he went up from Babylon and he was a ready scribe in the law of Moses, which the Lord God of Israel had given. And the king granted him all his request, according to the hand of the Lord his God upon him. So apparently he made a request. That's pretty bold to go into the king and say, I want something. And the king says, what do you want? That conversation is not recorded, but we do know from this verse he got his entire request and he's handed an edict or a decree from Artaxerxes, and it tells us what his request was and what the king had empowered him to do. We can see what Ezra's request was or were by the decree that Artaxerxes issued for him. The chief of these was to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem. So think about this now. He's a scribe. He's a high priest. He's probably more than likely been born in captivity. So he's never known Judah or Jerusalem. But for five kings, Israel has flourished back in Israel, building a second temple, which took 20-something years, building a city, building a wall, and for 38 years after the temple was completed, it ran unhindered. And now, for the first time, we have a king that he's serving who is against the Jews. What's going on back in Jerusalem that would turn this king against us? We've never had this. Not since Jeremiah's prophecy came to pass. Cyrus let us all go. We've been able to do anything we wanted to according to the good hand of God upon us and whatever he wanted. So Ezra, being a high priest, he knows that people are dirty. And also being a scribe, he knows that the law is the reason people fail. They don't have it. So his first request is evidently, let me go back to Judah and inquire of the people. I believe personally he wanted to see, where have we failed? What have we done to stop this revival? What have we done to cost us the favor? What have we done against our God? Because God's word doesn't fail. I believe Ezra's saying, what have we done? I'm never going to get it straight truth from them. I need to go investigate them for myself. So the first thing he apparently wants is, I want to go to Israel and I want to make inquiry. And that's what Ezra said. Granted him all his requests according to the hand of God, and his inquiry was to go and inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem, Ezra 7:14. For as much, this is what the king says, for as much then as thou art sent of the king and of his seven counselors, he's being sent, number one, back to Israel to inquire Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of thy God. He's going to go back and search them out and judge them according to the word. Because he wants to know, why has the revival failed? What have we done wrong? This is unprecedented. We have had 50-something years of unmitigated, unhindered favor with Persian pagans. Nobody could stop us. And now we have a good king who has now decided against us. It's not God's fault. It's not the king's fault. We must have failed. So, why would Ezra want to inquire of Judah and Jerusalem? Well, to see what Israel had done to lose favor with the first king in nearly 80 years. He wanted to investigate his people. Ezra was a scribe and a priest. If there was sin, he could bring about spiritual reforms to help his people. Upon his revival to Jerusalem, what he found was syncretism in the priesthood. That's the end of our lesson. He gets to Jerusalem, and what he finds is the priests have intermarried the Samaritans. It didn't take long to happen again. And that would answer why they lost favor. Because the people got dirty again. And it didn't take but half a generation. And it wouldn't take but half a generation in any church to lose revival. It wouldn't take but a month in a church to lose revival. If we afford or allow syncretism to come back in. Syncretism is, once again, that is the synchronizing of the holy with the profane. The attempted synchronization of the clean with the unclean. It results in a lukewarm body. It results in a lukewarm marriage. It results in a lukewarm faith. It results in this a spirit of compromise. Ezra gets back, and the first thing he finds is syncretism. The things they hated about the Samaritans had crept into the priesthood. And the whole rest of Ezra, which we'll study next week, is all about him issuing an official decree that says, if you don't divorce your Samaritan spouse and get rid of those quarter-breed Jew kids, you have no right, no portion, no inheritance in Israel, and you forfeit all your wealth. And that's called a spiritual reform, according to theologians. Ezra is called the spiritual reformist. He came in and promoted divorce to clean up the priesthood. And it was so rampant, it took 3 months to figure out who all was guilty of it. But it was the very reason they lost the revival for that season. It's the very reason the city was destroyed and set back. It's the very reason God had to raise up Nehemiah, was to clean up these idiots' mess. That's how subtle syncretism is. These folks were only one generation back into Israel, knowing very well what took them into slavery. And here they are doing it again, following in the sins of Solomon, marrying strange women. The devil knows how to kill you. Just get you to compromise one decision at a time. The devil knows that God himself will never set himself against you, but if the devil can get sin in your life, God will set himself against your sin and thereby set himself against you. It's the oldest trick in his book, and we fall prey to it over and over and over again. You want to know how to water down a church? Bring in entertainment. You want to know how to water down the move of God? Bring in gimmicks. Put in a light show. Build entertainment facilities. That's how you drive God out. That's how you bring the world in, but it's how you drive God out. We taught a couple weeks ago at the church in Knoxville that the Philistines got rid of the glory of God by putting it on a new cart pulled by milk cows. And for some reason, David, he just didn't have an understanding. He decided, for whatever strange reason, the best way to get God into Israel was the way the Philistines got rid of God. Put the Ark of the Covenant on a new cart pulled by milk cows. If it worked for the Philistines, if that's how they got rid of the glory, that should be a good way to bring in the glory. But that's exactly what we're watching churches in our community do. The very way the world has gotten rid of God, through entertainment, through gimmicks, that's what they do instead of God. Churches are now using that to try to bring the glory of God into the house. Entertainment, gimmicks, things that tickle their fancy, that's never going to bring God in. It's syncretism. It'll kill any revival. It'll draw great numbers of people. You got to know the population of Israel exploded because of all the intermarrying, but God wasn't anywhere near it. He was actually destroying it. We've got to be very, very careful of this thing called syncretism. This is a theme that comes up over and over again in Ezra and Nehemiah. Syncretism. Be either hot or cold, but if you be lukewarm, get ready to be flushed down the toilet because Jesus is going to puke you. That's what was going on here. It's as simple as that. Clear as day. Father, I thank you for this lesson. We thank you for our study on Ezra and Nehemiah and the post-exile return of Israel. Father, I thank you for giving us the understanding of the types and shadows. And Father, may this take root in our heart. May we glorify you in the days, weeks, and years ahead. In Jesus' name, amen.